This is just a guess, but I'd say we're at about the halfway point on this tax overhaul thing. An update on that for you today. Also, harassment in the political workplace. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today the 9th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two items with which to begin today. Item one, the Senate released its version of the GOP's tax bill this morning. Item two, the House Committee on Ways and Means passed its tax bill today. Party line as to be expected. So with that as backdrop, an interview now with Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council. Sadly, not my interview with Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council. John Harwood of CNBC had a chat with Cohn this morning. They talked about a bunch of stuff, including how important it is to the White House and Republicans in Congress that corporate taxes get cut. Here's Gary Cohn.
When you take a corporate tax rate at 35% and move it to 20%, and you see what's happened over the last two decades to businesses migrating out of the United States, migrating profits out of the United States, migrating domicile out of the United States, and hiring workers out of the United States, it's hard for me to not imagine that they're not going to bring businesses back to the United States. We create wage inflation, which means the workers get paid more, the workers have more disposable income, the workers spend more, and we see the whole trickle down through the economy. And that's good for the economy.
We let him go long because that's important stuff. But setting aside the offhand use of the not uncontroversial phrase trickle down, it's worth thinking here about what Gary Cohn said about wages, because that is the whole smash on this tax plan. That high corporate taxes in the United States, according to the Republicans, drive jobs overseas. So cutting those taxes, the GOP says, will bring jobs back and raise wages. Except historically, companies don't look to pay more. They look for more productive labor at lower cost. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
When a company is deciding where it wants to create new jobs, there are a few factors at play, says Tom Cullen at MIT's Sloan School of Management.
One, they have customers there, or there are some advantages in terms of location, or they go because there are lower labor costs.
Tax rates are further down on the list, he says, because companies rarely pay the full rate, and lowering it, says Cornell University Sarosh Kuravilla, won't change the dynamics of the global economy.
If you want hundreds and thousands of sewing machine workers, you're not going to find that in America. You're going to find that in China.
When companies do return to the U.S., they often automate lower-skilled jobs. But part of the argument for the tax cuts is that companies will invest their profits in creating more and better-paying jobs.
What raises wages in a sustainable way from the perspective of companies being able to pay their workers more is when those workers end up being more productive.
Matthew Slaughter of the Tuck School of Business. Of course, push wages up too high and even tax cuts won't keep some businesses here.
There's no magic wand that works quickly. What grows good jobs at good wages sustainably are a whole combination of sound public policies, one of which is the tax code.
And infrastructure and immigration and education, all factors, he says, play a role in creating jobs and keeping them here, which is rarely as simple as one tax cut. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're going to run one more piece of tape from that John Harwood-Gary Cohn interview, sort of a big picture thing about the tax ecosystem that we all live in. Harwood listing for the president's chief economic advisor how the tax plan breaks down.
Four times as much in business tax cuts and estate tax as for individuals.
Yep. But, John, if you look at what we're doing for middle-class taxpayers, the reality is kind of simple. The median income family in the United States, the family that earns about $60,000 in the United States, the speaker talked about them getting an $1,182 tax cut. That family is now paying a marginal tax rate of less than 1%.
Oh, if only our taxes were so simple. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes it from there.
Cutting federal income tax sounds like a winning proposition, but Jim Rapetti at Boston College Law School says federal income taxes are the least of middle-class Americans' worries.
If you assume that the average state and local income tax is 9% and the average sales tax is around 8%, and then you add in the Social Security and Medicare taxes, you're talking some serious money.
Some economists argue that if you really want to give the middle class a tax break, you'd focus on the tax that pays for Social Security and Medicare. payroll tax. According to the Tax Policy Center, 62% of all tax-paying households paid more this year in payroll taxes than income taxes. Bob Goulder at the think tank Tax Analysts says one argument for not cutting payroll taxes is that some consider them a kind of user fee.
They say, well, if your payroll tax goes for Medicare, you're just paying for future health services. And that's distinct enough that we're not going to view it as a real tax.
But Romina Baccia at the Heritage Foundation says the plan to double the standard federal income tax deduction will directly benefit the middle class. And it'll make filing your taxes more simple.
Families making $114,000 a year in income would face a tax rate no higher than 12%. So that provides great tax relief to middle-class families.
What the Trump administration hopes those families do with that income is invest it or make purchases and keep the economy growing. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One thing we haven't talked about tax-wise in a while is how these cuts are going to be paid for. GOP is not just going after the big pots of money to do it, things like state and local tax deductions or mortgage interest deductions. The net is really quite wide, and it includes the thousands of graduate students who take advantage of certain tax breaks to offset the cost of their sometimes epic educations. Tax breaks that can pay off for their schools as well. Marketplace's Erica Barris has a look at what's at stake there.
When Barmak Nasirian saw the tax bill proposed by House Republicans, his first thought was,
that's the end of research in the United States.
That's because many schools depend on graduate students to work as research assistants. Nasirian is with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
Taxing a phantom benefit, a de facto coupon, you know, that discounts tuition, is not the way to promote expansion of research in this country.
For those of us without PhDs, Nasirian is referring to tuition waivers. Grad students earn a stipend for research and teaching, anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 a year, and pay tax on it. But lots of grad students also receive tuition waivers that are tax-free. Under the House plan, waivers would be treated as income.
Their tax bill is going to effectively be a very high percentage of the income that they're getting to live off of.
Kim Dancy is an education policy analyst with think tank New America.
To cut into that further could discourage people from enrollment.
STEM students will take the biggest hit because they make up around 60% of PhD students. But everyone is worried. Jeffrey Melnick runs the American Studies grad program at the University of Massachusetts Boston, where up to 50% of tuition is waived for students.
I'm literally thinking about the students who were around my seminar table last night, and I can say almost with no doubt that we would lose 75% of those students.
Grad students don't have the lobbying firepower of many industry groups, but they're hoping the big universities that depend on them do. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
You remember when Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the markets are banking on that corporate tax cut and bad things might happen to the rally if it doesn't happen? Believe you me, traders are not wild about the Senate tax plan pushing back a corporate cut for a year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's that big UN climate meeting this week in Germany, and for the second straight year, American elections are part of the conversation. Last year, the largely unexpected win by President Trump shook things up because of his campaign promise to leave the Paris Climate Agreement, which he has now made good on. So given that lack of federal action in the United States on climate change, there is a lot more focus on the states themselves, which brings us to two governors-elect who won on Tuesday, Democrats Ralph Northam in Virginia and Phil Murphy in New Jersey, who want to get their states into a regional carbon trading program. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim explains that one.
Nine northeastern states are currently part of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI. They cap carbon emissions from power plants and then auction off permits to pollute. The money mostly goes to fund clean energy. Dallas Bertraw is with the think tank Resources for the Future. He says adding Virginia and New Jersey would make the market much bigger.
The broader the market, the less volatility, or that's what economists tend to think, and the more stable the program going forward.
Virginia in particular is what you might call a big get for a carbon market. Lots of emissions. Mark Kresiewicz is with the Sierra Club.
It would increase the overall amount of pollution covered by the program by nearly 50%.
Now, in the global scheme of climate change, it's not huge, and most experts say the U.S. won't meet its emissions targets without federal action. But Bertros says getting Virginia would be a boost, a highly symbolic one.
To be joined by a southern state, a state that historically has been a coal state, is really a remarkable turn of events.
Bill Shobe teaches public policy at the University of Virginia. He says if a largely centrist state like Virginia wants to join RGGI, that could reassure more states that cutting emissions can work economically.
Here's one possible way of solving this problem that can keep the cost of addressing CO2 emissions as low as possible.
He says if Virginia and New Jersey do join, 20% of all U.S. states will be on track to meet the Paris Agreement goals. I'm Jed Gibb for Marketplace.
I'm going to coin a phrase here, the Weinstein list. Men in prominent positions who've been accused of sexual harassment and fundamentally abuse of power. Weinstein, Spacey, Oreskes, now today two others. The New York Times has published allegations by five women against the comedian Louis C.K. And getting into national politics for the first time, the Washington Post reports four women say Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore sexually touched them, that's the paper's words, when they were teenagers. Moore, in a statement, called the story outlandish. But here in California, more than 140 women from all sides of the political spectrum signed an open letter published in the Los Angeles Times last month alleging sexual harassment at the state capitol. Jody Hicks is a principal at the Sacramento lobbying firm Damari Brown Hicks and Kessler. She was also one of the first signatories of that letter that was published. Jody, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You've been in and around politics and the legislative process for a good long while, right?
Yeah, more than 15 years.
How long did it take before you had an incident of whatever severity and you said, you know what, this is not cool?
So what's interesting for me is I actually got into politics a little bit older than others. I was around 30 years old. Mm. So I will say I've had something happen to me at every industry that I've worked at. So it wasn't brand new in politics for me. It was different. But I would say maybe 2 weeks. And I will also say every woman I know has had something happen to them.
Every woman you know?
In every industry. Every woman I know.
There are a couple of things that make politics different, I guess, in a lot of ways. But one of the biggies, especially in this circumstance, is that there's no HR in politics. I mean, it's not like you can go to the human resources and say, hey, this happened to me.
Right. The human resources is what we call rules committee, which is a committee made up of other members. If you come forward and file a complaint, the rules committee, if you're a staffer in the building, that rules committee for the rest of your career is in charge of okaying a salary increase that you request, for instance. If you're a lobbyist and you file a claim, those committee members are members that you have to lobby later. So one thing that we can all have a good conversation is what is the appropriate way to file complaints, to talk about this issue, and it really should be an independent party. I think that hopefully is one of the policy changes that we can see.
About Sacramento specifically, are there changes in, I guess the phrase would be like complaint protocol or something. I mean, are there changes coming in the way these things get handled since this letter? Do you know?
Well, I know there's conversation about it, and the Senate has hired an outside consultants and outside firms to look at the policies and see if there needs to be changes. So there certainly is a discussion and conversation about how to move forward. And that's really the conversation that needs to happen.
Do you get that sense that it is? Is this a germinating moment here?
Yeah, I think there is change that's going to happen, and I think it will be for the better. But I think it's going to be uncomfortable along the way. And I'll tell you, our firm is women-owned. And just today, I actually heard from one of my clients that they had reached out with a member to talk about setting up a meeting and potentially drinks, which is where a lot of our meetings happen. And they had pause with meeting with our firm because some of the legislators had talked about no longer having drinks with women lobbyists.
Yeah, that would be just business terrible for you, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So certainly, clearly, there's going to be some ramifications for all of this. And it might be hard on my business. It might be better. I don't know. But there's no way to get through it and have change happen without having the conversation and doing the work.
Jody Hicks is a lobbyist up in Sacramento. She's a principal at the firm Damari Brown Hicks and Kessler. She is also a signatory to the letter about sexual harassment in the California State Legislature. Jody, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up.
There is no shopping element. This is a space where you come and shop for food.
I'll have the food court, please. Hold the mall. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 101 points today, 0.4%, closed at 23,461. The Dow off 253 at the low today. The NASDAQ closed off 39 points, about 0.5%. 0.5% is another way to say that. Finished at 6,750. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, 0.3%, 25.84. Macy's up 10.9% today. Posted better than expected third quarter profits, which put down to cost and inventory controls. Kohl's posted worse than expected third quarter profits, but it still rose 0.9% because capitalism. JCPenney picked up 9.5%. Today, bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.33%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Water is probably the most basic of natural resources. But you take that resource, you put it into a poorly supervised, regionally fractured, and unequal economic system, and nothing good happens. Specifically here, I'm talking about water in the Chicago area, the subject of a recent series in the Chicago Tribune. Patrick O'Connell was one of the reporters on that series. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Do me a favor and give me the 30,000-foot view of the Lake Michigan, Chicago water infrastructure, if you would.
Absolutely. So what we found was that there's a wide disparity of what Chicagoans and Chicago suburbanites pay for their water. There's a wide network of towns that get their water from Lake Michigan. Some of them get them from Chicago. Some of them, it goes through a series of two or three towns. Sometimes there's markups in the wholesale rates because of that, and then it's passed on to consumers. But sometimes that's not the case. How far you are away from Lake Michigan doesn't always correspond with how much you pay for water.
There's also the problem, in addition to the rate-paying disparity, which is enormous and egregious, there's just an unbelievable amount of water just being wasted.
Absolutely. We found that there are towns that lose upwards of 35-38% of their water, and towns have a really hard time finding out where their water goes and making sure that their pipes are up to speed in technologically in how water gets delivered to people.
Get me back to, for a second, the disparity in communities and what they pay. You guys found African Americans pay a disproportionately higher set of rates than more affluent communities do. There are some great anecdotes in this piece. The guy whose water got cut off, I think, while he was doing his dishes, right?
Yes. So we found a man and interviewed him. Robert Hilton is his name. And he came home. He tried to do his dishes and found out that his water was off. That's something, a problem that we found with a lot of people, especially in minority and less affluent communities, is that they have a hard time paying these skyrocketing water bills. And then their water would get shut off. And then the other problem we had with that was residents were not being able to pay the high amounts that these towns would charge to have their water reconnected. They find themselves deeper and deeper in this hole for a basic resource.
Just to widen this out a little bit, and I know it wasn't a focus of your reporting, but Chicago and the surrounding area is not the only place in the country where water infrastructure is in terrible, terrible shape.
That's true. And we focused obviously on Chicago because Lake Michigan is a precious resource, and there's been, over time, a fight about who has access to it, right? This is something that the surrounding states that border Lake Michigan and all of the Great Lakes are very protective of. So when other states try to come in and say, hey, we're having a problem getting water, Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and so on, are saying, no, this is only for our residents. And so it is a problem nationwide. You're right.
Patrick O'Connell at the Chicago Tribune. Great series in that paper, two-parter, on the water system in that area. Patrick, thanks a lot.
Kai, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
We've reported with some degree of detail the past couple of years about the demise of the shopping mall. As those malls have gone away, so too have their food courts. Not, generally speaking, huge gastronomic losses, right? In some cities, though, those food courts are giving way to food halls. Ritzier and foodier, I guess you'd say. Los Angeles is expected to open 7 food halls next year. They're also coming to smaller cities like Waco, Texas, and Greenville, South Carolina. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank explains what's going on there.
L.A.'s newest food hall is here on the ground floor of the Corporation Building, a 14-story high-rise in the heart of downtown that was recently flipped into creative offices. David Takis spent a recent lunch hour on the patio with an $11 bowl of fresh ravioli.
I woke up dreaming of this pasta, so I'm happy to actually fulfill that dream today.
Inside, there's sleek communal seating and 8 food stalls, each a couple hundred square feet. They're serving everything from rice bowls and shawarma to poke and pulled pork.
We like the choices that we have. It's just nice to be spontaneous.
The food hall concept, quick, sophisticated dining in a public market setting, came from Europe before taking off in the U.S. There were about 100 scattered across the country last year, and 100 more are expected by next year. Some small operations like this one, others massive spaces packed with 40 or more vendors.
It's kind of a new age food court.
Simon Aronson likes that his choices here aren't the national fast food chains you'd find at the mall, but representatives of the local food scene. Many food halls host downmarket versions of renowned restaurants.
I have the ability to come to one spot and choose from multiple types of places that are much, much healthier than the traditional food courts and malls that we might have been privy to in the past.
Developers around the country have a big appetite for food halls to anchor their office parks or luxury condos, says food industry analyst Warren Solichek with the NPD Group. And the brick-and-mortar retail downturn is fueling the trend.
You have large retail and office space that has become open, and the owners of the buildings are looking to fill in those large spaces.
But that doesn't mean you can just plop a food hall anywhere. Solichek says he hasn't seen any high-profile flops yet, but food halls share the same risk as with any dining destination.
If you get into a space where you don't have a lot of foot traffic, it's just not going to be successful.
Unlike its standard mall food courts, the restaurants at Corporation Food Hall aren't competing with retail shops, says Jamal Bryant, manager at Tsum Tsum, a fresh Mediterranean spot. For now, at least, they aren't found in malls.
There is no shopping element. This is a space where you come and shop for food.
Compared to a full-service restaurant, Bryant says there are a lot of advantages for him to operate here.
I don't have to worry about a dining room. I don't have to worry about front of the house. I don't have to worry about cleaning restrooms. I don't have to worry about parking.
Overhead costs are much lower, and it's a stepping stone for chefs like Akeem Wong, who owns Thai fusion stall Buddha Belly. Wong started a food truck in L.A. 3 years ago and wants to run a full-on restaurant someday.
If I really wanted to open up my own spot, probably be like double or triple what I'm spending here. And it's just way more risky, and it's like a good step from a food truck to this, and then maybe the next step would be an actual standalone spot.
We're less than a mile from what is now L.A.'s most famous food hall, Grand Central Market. It began a century ago as a true public market and has seen a culinary transformation in recent years as more young people revitalized Los Angeles's downtown. That urban renewal is definitely contributing to the national growth of food halls. Nicole LeBlanc, who lives and works nearby, is spending her lunch hour at Corporation Food Hall with her family.
And it's great to be or feel like you're part of the city again.
Now, that's one you probably won't hear at your suburban mall food court. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I'm sure sharp-eyed viewers of the Weather Channel have already noticed. Ad Age reports that the broadcasters got a new outerwear partner, the parkas and raincoats and whatnot that their meteorologists wear on camera in the big storms. Land's End is in, L.L. Bean is out after a dozen years. Apparently, and this was news to me, the deal also includes on-air mentions of how Land's End gear does in given weather conditions. Because altogether now, branding is everything. All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 101 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ down 39, 0.5%, 0.5%. S&P 500 off 9 points, about 0.3%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, but the clock is ticking, is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.